This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about investing. My colleague, Ben Levison, is off today, so I'll be joined instead by David Giroux of T. Rowe Price, who manages the firm's capital appreciation strategy, including the $50 billion T. Rowe Price Capital Appreciation Fund. The ticker is PRWCX. David is also head of investment strategy at T. Rowe Price and holds other posts at the firm. He is a five-time nominee, two-time winner of Morningstar's Fund Manager of the Year Award in the allocation category, and he's about to become a first-time author. His book, appropriately called Capital Allocation, will be published by McGraw-Hill this fall. Congratulations on that, David, and thank you for joining us on Barron's Live today.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Glad to have you here. So we're going to talk about stocks today, but before we do, I just have to say, how about that Richard Branson? Are you going to sign up to become a space tourist too?
I don't think T. Rowe would let me do that.
Markets are too exciting. We don't have to go to outer space.
That's true.
So it was quite an accomplishment though, and quite an excitement for the weekend. So let's move on to stocks. We won't even get into the soccer match. We'll go directly to stocks. So let's begin with the subject of capital allocation. You've won awards for being a great allocator. You've written a book, obviously, about it. Why is capital allocation so important? And how do you think ordinary investors ought to think about it?
Sure. So, you know, I think the role of capital allocation is becoming more and more important over time relative to what it was in the past. You know, generally speaking, we are in a world of slower economic growth. Maybe not this year, maybe not next year. But generally speaking, economic growth across the developed world is slowing. And in that environment, companies just have more excess capital to deploy. And the success rate on capital deployment is becoming a more meaningful contributor, whether you are an outperforming stock or an underperforming stock over time. And so, you know, identifying companies that can deploy capital well with good returns is really going to be a critical thing to be able to generate alpha for both from a stock perspective and from a company perspective going forward. In many respects, Lauren, I can trace a lot of my success, I think, as a portfolio manager over the last 15 years to investing with companies that deploy capital exceptionally well and aligning myself with that strategy. And, you know, whether it be a Thermo or a Danaher, a Marsh McLennan, a PerkinElmer, those stocks have been really good stocks over a long period of time because they deploy capital so exceptionally well.
So what are the hallmarks of a great capital allocator as a company?
It really comes down to returns and kind of the amount of free cash flow a company generates. So the more free cash flow a company generates, the more capital they have potentially to deploy. And again, we can look at examples over time over the last 20 years of companies that had very similar organic growth rates, but some companies that did extraordinarily well from capital deployment, being able to buy things, improve them, and actually generate good returns in the process for other companies out there that historically had not done as nearly as good a job and had seen their stocks trail the market, sometimes substantially in the case of like GE during the AMLT era.
So it's all about the capital allocation.
It's all about capital allocation.
We've just rounded the first half of the year. The major U.S. stock averages are at all-time highs, and they're on track to make new ones today if things hold up. Yet you have spoken to me about the disconnect you see between the stock market and the real economy. So what sort of disconnect is it, and what do you think is causing it?
Well, I think right now it's a very buoyant time in the market, right? We are going to have earnings in the market for the S&P 500 will probably be at records this year. And actually, we will probably earn more in 2021 than we would have if we had never had a pandemic in the first place. So we have had an amazing recovery, really unprecedented recovery in the economy in S&P 500 earnings. The challenge, though, is a lot of that is being driven by a lot of kind of stimulus-induced spending behavior by consumers. And the real question in my mind is, as a lot of consumers spend that stimulus that was given to them at the end of last year, earlier this year, how much, what is going to be the flow through after that stimulus is kind of gone? And so we are likely to see very strong earnings this year in the marketplace. But as we go out into 22 and 23, and some of that stimulus money has already been spent, what happens to economic growth? What happens to S&P 500 growth? And I think the most likely scenario is growth slows dramatically off a very high level today, you know, this year. And again, the market tends to look at what's going on today or tomorrow, as opposed to what's going to happen 6 months, 12 months, 3 years out, which is where our focus is. So if you think about that, that really means slower growth next year, slower growth going into a high, with a very high multiple already, is really not a great backdrop.
So do you expect the market to retreat significantly as we go out further into the year and into next year?
I think it's very difficult to make short-term market calls, you know, whether what's going to happen next 6 months or 9 months. What I feel confident in is the backdrop's not a great backdrop, right? And does that mean the market, goes down a little bit, the market flatlines for a period of time and kind of adjusts to this higher valuation? It's hard to say. But what I would say is, if you think about the long-term equity returns of the market being 8%, kind of 6% EPS growth, 2% dividend yield, I think over the next 3 to 5 years, given the high valuation we're starting at, the strong sentiment in the marketplace, I think, and probably decelerating economic growth and EPS growth the next couple of years, it is likely, more likely than not, returns will be below the long-term average, I think, over the next 3 to 5 years.
Making capital allocation all the more important.
Absolutely. And stock selection as well.
Yes. So we're about to kick off second quarter earnings. Looking at the near term, the banks will start reporting this week. Are there any second quarter earnings reports you're particularly interested in hearing?
No, in many respects, Lauren, it's actually probably less about what companies report in Q2 and more about what happens in the second half of the year and their outlook for the second half of the year. You know, again, this is going to be the easiest comparison of the year, probably one of the easiest comparisons in history, because we're basically going up against the pandemic last year and its nadir, if you will. So it's a little bit less important what companies report this year, but more about also how the market reacts to those earnings and what is the outlook for the second half of the year. Again, I expect the outlook to continue to be robust. Again, I'm more concerned about more when we get to kind of Q3, Q4, and companies start giving guidance for 22 against more difficult comparisons. Does the market get more concerned about that then, at that time?
So you'll really be listening for the guidance as opposed to the backward look.
I think that's absolutely fair.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So I want to get to some of your favorite stocks, but before I do, I want to talk about the fixed income market. And before I even do that, I'd like to remind our listeners that we'll take questions at the end of the call. We've already got quite a few coming in, and we welcome more. So please type them in as we talk. Let's talk about fixed income for a moment, David. Many people expected the 10-year Treasury yield to be approaching 2% by now. After all, the economy is getting stronger. Inflation looks to be a little problematic. Instead, the 10-year yield is now down around 1.35%. Something does not compute. What do you think the bond market is telling us?
Well, the bond market is telling us, to a certain extent, what I talked about before, is that we are likely to have robust economic growth this year, higher than average inflation because of supply chain disruptions in this very robust economy. But as we go into 22 and 23, I think what the bond market is kind of saying is growth's going to slow, inflation's going to revert back to normal. And maybe in that environment, maybe the Fed won't be raising rates as aggressively as the market thinks or used to think in that environment. I think that's really what's going on. That's why I think you see the 10-year at 135. I don't think the 10-year at 135 is that attractive at all. We don't own a lot of long-duration assets. But having said that, I think that the bond market is telling something very different than the equity market. The equity market is kind of implying high rates forever, high economic growth forever, whereas the bond market is taking a little bit more of a longer-term view and saying growth is likely to slow, inflation is likely to slow, and that's why rates are coming down.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me like you believe the bond market's message more than you believe the stock market's message.
I do. I think that's very accurate.
Well, let's look a little further into the credit markets. And you've been intrigued by leveraged loans. You find them attractive relative to other fixed income assets. I wonder if you can explain to those who don't know what leveraged loans are and why they've been outperforming.
Sure. Happy to do that. And again, I love leveraged loans. Leveraged loans are really the senior most part of a firm's capital structure. they have three really unique characteristics. They have very, very low default rates. And even if secondarily, even if you have a default, the recovery rates tend to be very, very high. So you really don't lose a lot of principal in leveraged loans. And third, they're floating rate in nature, which is really different than all other fixed income asset classes, in that when rates rise, if the Fed were to raise rates, you actually get higher income with leveraged loans versus traditional fixed income assets where they tend to go down in value if rates were to rise. And so if you look today, you're kind of earning kind of a 4% yield, which is three times the yield of treasuries. It's twice the yield of investment grade bonds. It's just a very attractive risk reward. So if I'm right and rates stay low, you're going to get a really good yield relative to other fixed income asset classes. If rates rise and other fixed income asset classes go down in value, leveraged loans will rise in value. And I guess the only way, only place you kind of lose value in leveraged loans here relative to traditional fixed income is if rates fall dramatically, which I don't see per se. So it's a really attractive risk reward skew. And again, the nice thing again about being here at T. Rowe too is we have a five-star rated fund run by Paul Massaro. It's our T. Rowe Price floating rate strategy. It has a yield like 4.4%. It's a fund that I own personally. It's a fund that I actually own within the capital appreciation strategy. And I think it's a really good fund for people who are looking for some income, but who are worried about rates rising in the future.
Can you give us the ticker for that fund? Because I'm sure readers will want to know.
That is a good question. And I should know the answer to that. And I apologize. I was not prepared for that. I apologize. Okay. Sorry.
I'll ask you just to repeat the name of the fund then.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that, Lauren. It is the T. Rowe Price Floating Rate Fund. Again, it's run by a gentleman named Paul Massaro, who's a good friend of mine.
Thank you. So as long as we're talking about stocks and bonds together, what do you think of the argument that the 60-40 portfolio has outlived its usefulness?
No, in many respects, and I run a balanced strategy. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in the 60-40. I never have believed, and I still don't believe it today. And part of the issue is that, you know, when I first became a portfolio manager 15 years ago, you got the 10-year was at 5%. That was a really attractive yield and also provided downside protection. Today, the value of the fixed income component, traditional fixed income component of a 60-40 portfolio is just much less attractive. It's really only, you're not getting a very attractive yield. You're not getting a really good yield above inflation. And you're taking a lot more risk because as when rates go down, duration goes up, which means small changes in interest rates can have a disproportionate impact on the underlying value of the fixed income instrument. So it's far less attractive than it used to be. So again, the way we build CAF is not through a 60-40 lens. It's through, let's find the asset classes out there and the sectors that have the best risk-adjusted return, that provide the best downside. So that instead of having a traditional 60-40, we have a portfolio filled with really attractive GARP stocks, really attractive utilities, some attractive growth stocks, a lot of cover call overwriting, leveraged loans, not a lot of traditional fixed income. Because the traditional fixed income, the risk-adjusted returns just aren't that good from here.
Mm-hmm. So that's quite a hodgepodge of assets.
It is.
Let's talk a bit more about the equity part of that allocation. You mentioned that you like growth at a reasonable price or GARP stocks. You mentioned pure growth stocks and you mentioned utilities. So what are the attractions of each of those categories?
Well, I think growth, you know, and let's start with GARP stocks. You know, GARP stocks are, you know, there's been this tug of war all year long between kind of growth stocks on one end and value stocks on the other end. And what's kind of been left behind are these kind of, you know, GARPy stocks. It's about 13-14% of the S&P 500 is what I characterize as GARPy stocks. These are companies that will grow earnings basically 1.5 times the market over a long period of time, usually with very strong free cash flow conversion, usually with lower risk than that overall market. And they've kind of just been left behind in the marketplace. And they look really, really attractive today on a risk-adjusted return basis, especially given the fact that we're at such a high level in the equity market today. So, you know, companies like Humana, United Healthcare, where these are companies, Lauren, that should probably be able to grow earnings over the next 5 years, maybe twice that of the S&P 500 with much lower volatility, that are trading at a discount to the market today on earnings and free cash flow, which is just not justified by the fundamentals, where we see really good value in GARP there. You know, in growth stocks, growth stocks have had a nice run in the last couple of weeks, but we still see really good value in like a company like Amazon today. You know, Amazon was rallied from 3,100 to 3,700. There's still really good value there. as you know, over the next couple of years, you see the benefit from on their AWS business from being in a pandemic that's going to drive faster adoption of the cloud from the Fortune 1000 customer base. You're seeing that their advertising business, which is high margin, grow at a very accelerated pace. And you're also seeing Amazon roll out kind of more one day and same day shipping options, which has big benefits for their TAM, for their, you know, when you can get a good or service or good from Amazon, you're delivered same day, it really opens up their market, their addressable market opportunity dramatically. And then we've already talked about utilities. Utilities are, again, they've been left behind in the marketplace, but utilities are on the right side of ESG. They offer kind of 6% EPS growth today, 3% dividend yield, double, you know, high single digit, low double digit kind of total returns at a really discounted value because, again, they've been left behind in this kind of growth versus value rally. And they look very, very attractive. You have a 3 to 5 year view.
All right. So two questions going back to these topics. Are you worried much about regulation of tech stocks like Amazon?
No. And actually, I would actually argue that Amazon is the least of all the big tech companies. I'd be much more worried about Apple, be much more worried about Facebook, and maybe, you know, Google number three. But I think Amazon is probably the least impacted by any kind of tech regulation. The concerns regulators have around Amazon are really, really minor and really, really centered around their kind of private label business, which is a very, very low single digit part of their business. If that part of the business went away, it would be de minimis. It would not even matter.
Interesting. And then going back to utilities, can you give us the names of some utilities that you find particularly interesting here?
Sure. And I will say we're buying utilities actively as we speak today. So one name that I think is quite attractive right now is Exelon. Exelon has a regulated utility in the Midwest, as well as a unregulated asset, which is the largest producer of nuclear generation in the United States. And they are, this year, they're going through a process of spinning off their unregulated asset, which should hopefully create some value for shareholders as some of the parts discount is unlocked. But I think what's really interesting about Exelon is their unregulated asset, because they are, as I said, they're the largest producer of carbon-free energy in the United States through their nuclear operations. And nuclear energy is the only type of clean energy that is not subsidized by the federal or state governments in the US. And as a result of that, you know, a lot of merchant generation in the nuclear fleet could potentially close down in the next 5 years. And that would have to be replaced by more dirty fuel, you know, coal, natural gas, if you will, in some of these markets. So I think the Biden administration is very, very focused on making sure these nuclear facilities stay open. And they could provide additional subsidies, which would be a boon for Exelon, as well as PEG, which is another utility that we own that has some unregulated nuclear assets as well. And so, we're not counting on that, Lauren. But if that plays out, that could be a really big boon for Exelon, and maybe a secondary boon for PEG.
Interesting. To what degree do dividends matter to you?
Dividends matter a lot, but I think it's hard to make. It's hard to make a generalization too about whether you like dividend stocks or you don't like dividend stocks as well. So like I said, there are parts of companies that have very attractive dividend yields whereby their companies are under secular challenge, secular risk, and those dividends are not sustainable. So some companies that have really had attractive dividend yields, we have no interest in. But then I also mentioned like utilities as a place where dividend yields look really, really attractive. That 3% dividend yield is very, very attractive relative to traditional fixed income instruments, where you're earning 1 or 2%. I would say as a general rule today, I favor dividend stocks that offer sustainable dividend yields of 2 to 3% relative to traditional fixed income investments, we're only earning 1 or 2%. And you're not actually even keeping up with inflation in many of those instruments. So dividend stocks over traditional fixed income.
Interesting. Thank you. We have a lot of questions today. You have quite a fan club. So I think I'm going to go to some listener questions, and then we'll circle back and cover a few more things. We have a question from Gordon. Well, actually, you've answered much of his question about your forecast for electric utility stocks, but he wonders, what's your forecast for the industry over the next decade?
If there's only one sector I could invest in for the next 10 years, from this starting point, it would be probably the utility industry, because the fundamentals are so good right now, and are likely to be good for the next 20 years as we go through this transition of really an energy grid that was really driven by coal and natural gas to one that's really driven by renewables and storage, and maybe over time, even hydrogen. That's going to be a very powerful trend for these utilities, which will allow them to maintain or even potentially accelerate their growth rates while still paying a very attractive dividend yield, as well as you know, so, and also being very, very attractive on an ESG perspective as they take a tremendous amount of carbon out of the air. So I think, you know, the 20-year story for utilities looks really, really good. And again, right now the market's just focused on what we're looking at today. We're looking at high inflation, we're looking at, you know, low rates. The market just doesn't care about utilities. But over a 5 and 10 year basis, I think the market's going to care a lot more about utilities. Utilities are really compelling relative to traditional fixed income. They're very compelling on an ESG perspective. And they're just very, very compelling on a risk-adjusted return basis from here.
Do you recommend buying individual names or a utility fund or some combination of the two?
Well, actually, it's a really good question that I thought a little bit about as people have asked this question in the past. What I would say is I actually prefer owning individual utilities, because what you want in utilities is you want a good regulatory environment, you want a good management team, and you want attractive valuation. So a lot of the utilities we own have all those characteristics, whether it be an Exelon or a PEG, definitely have those characteristics. A Ameren has those characteristics that can benefit from this clean energy revolution we're all going to experience in the next 20 years. But not all utilities will benefit from that in the same way. And some utilities actually trade at, you know, like a NextEra trades at a very, very high valuation relative to some of the parts. So I'm not usually a fan of buying an ETF. So I think, you know, Ameren, Exelon, PEG are all very, very attractive utilities from my perspective.
Thanks for that. We have a question from John, and I think it's a question many people will relate to. How do you construct a diversified portfolio in a market of extended valuations?
It's a great question, something we struggle with a lot. So what we are focused on is we're trying to focus on building a portfolio that can keep up as best as we possibly can in a expensive market, right? That's what we always do in the market season. We try to keep up as best we can, but we're not trying to shoot the lights out, right? We're not trying to take too much risk. So what we are really focused on today is finding securities that can keep up with the market to a certain extent, but also names that will, if the market were to correct, like it did at the end of 18, like it did in February, stocks that have very low downside ratios and asset classes that have very low downside ratios. So we're trying to keep up as best as we can in a speculative market, but also protect our clients on the downside. So if the market were to correct 20 or 25%, our downside capture would be so much more dramatic, so much less dramatic, because we built a portfolio really tilted towards garpy stocks that have low downside ratios, utilities that have very low downside ratios, leveraged loans that have very low volatility. So we're trying to build a portfolio, kind of an all-weather portfolio, that has a really attractive risk reward skew. That's really what we're doing on a day-to-day basis these days.
So Manu asks a question that we sometimes take for granted. It seems like an elementary question, but it's really at the heart of investing. How do you figure out whether a stock is overvalued?
Well, I think there's multiple different ways to think about it. You can look at it relative to its own historical trading range. You can look at it relative to its peers. You can look at it relative to companies who have similar algorithm or similar combination of EPS growth or free cash flow growth and dividend yield, and look at where it's trading relative to other companies are trading. So it's like, I think, you know, I mentioned earlier, like NextEra is becoming a darling of the ESG investment community. It trades at 10 points higher than it's historically traded relative to its peers. And it has a very similar EPS growth, right? But if you look 3 or 4 years in the past, it traded a small premium, now trades at a giant premium. Is that giant premium likely to persist? Maybe, probably not. Companies that have a similar EPS growth rate tend to trade for similar valuations. Because sometimes things come in favor, out of favor, for a variety of reasons. So when things get extended relative to where they've historically traded relative to its peers, we're usually selling into those events. And we're usually buying things that are kind of trading at a discount where they've historically traded, usually because those stocks don't agree with what I call the current macroeconomic consensus of the market. We're usually betting against the macroeconomic consensus of the market more often than not.
And you're not talking about the price per se. You're talking about a multiple of earnings or price relative to earnings, price relative to cash flow or some other ratio like that.
Lauren, that's absolutely right. It's not the absolute price. It's just really that valuation on an absolute basis, on a relative basis, looking at earnings, looking at cash flow, and looking at what we think they'll actually grow earnings at the next 5 years. And what is that IRR? What is the expected return our investors who buy this stock are likely to achieve over the next 5 years? That's how we think about stocks. And when you get a very high valuation, you assume the valuation comes down over time. Yeah, that multiple compression can really eat into investors' returns on a longer term basis.
Well, I'm glad Manu asked the question because we tend to take this for granted.
That's a good question.
When talking about stocks. So we have a question from Steve who wants to know, what's your forecast for the European market and for global markets given the current COVID situation?
It's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, and I think I understand the spirit of the question, because the U.S. is recovering right now. I mean, we're going to have a strong Q1 earnings, we have strong Q2 earnings. And the question is, you know, Europe's kind of one quarter behind the U.S. Maybe Japan's like two quarters behind the U.S. and emerging markets are maybe three quarters behind the U.S. So that's all very fair. So a natural idea would be, well, let's go buy European stocks, let's go buy Japanese stocks, let's go buy emerging market companies. That makes sense. The problem is a lot of those markets, whether Europe or Japan, they're already anticipating this recovery in their earnings forecast. So while they're behind us, their markets are a little bit more forward-looking and they're already pricing that in. So European markets are less expensive than the U.S. market. Emerging markets are less expensive than the U.S. market, but at the same time, they're not as good at companies. You know, Europe doesn't have the same GARP stocks. They don't have the same high-quality utilities that we have. They don't have the really great growth companies that we have. It's really a market that's really driven by financials, by energy, by materials, and what I call lower quality companies. So again, call me a homer here, but I always favor the US index over the European index. And if you want to get exposure to companies that have exposure to Europe or Japan or emerging markets, you can do that in droves by investing in a US company. There's a number of companies in my portfolio today that have over half their revenues coming from Europe and emerging markets, that just because they're domiciled in the U.S. So I think this is always kind of a misnomer that people feel like to get exposure to Europe or Japan or emerging markets, you have to invest in those companies that are headquartered there. I think that's wrong. I think over time, investing in a broad portfolio of attractive multinational companies that deploy capital well will create more value than investing in European and Japanese or emerging market companies.
All right, so you left out China in this discussion. How do you think an investor should think about China, given the regulatory issues not only in the U.S., but now in China?
I think it's a really good question, Lauren. It's a really good question. And I think, you know, whether it be what's happened over the weekend with Tencent or with the DiDi IPO, I think there's just a question of kind of, not, I don't know if it's rule of law, but the ability to change rule of law on a dime, if you will. That should cause some concern for investors who want to invest in China. And again, I would say the same thing I said about Europe is there's a lot of companies out there that have 10, 50% of their revenues in China that are really well positioned to benefit from the growth in Chinese economy, the growth of the Chinese consumer over a long period of time, but where you don't take the same kind of risk on a individual company basis that you do in investing in China. So again, we've chosen not to invest in companies in China that are domiciled in China. We have not participated in any of these IPOs or even potential IPOs. I think it's not the right risk-adjusted return for our fund.
Well said. We have a question from Howard. How will the effect of the Biden economic plan, assuming it passes, and potential increases in corporate taxation affect the market longer term?
Well, it's a good question. Now, I'd say two things. On the tax issue, I think there's a general view that if the tax rates are kind of somewhere in the middle, a corporate tax rate 25%, a guilty tax rate of 15-17, you know, this is going to be a manageable process for most companies. It'll probably impact the S&P 500 by about 5%. But it does go to the earlier question you asked, Lauren, that growth rates next year are probably going to slow naturally against this very difficult comparison. You add in like a 5-point headwind from higher tax rates next year, that could be another challenge for the market next year that we talked about. I would also say when we think about, you know, what will probably be $2 to $2.5 trillion of additional spending, that sounds like a very large number. And it is a very large number, especially given the size of the deficits we're running up today. But that's over like probably over an 8 or 10 year period. That's actually relatively small. It sounds crazy talking about $2.5 trillion being small, but it's relatively small relative to the stimulus that we provided over the last year and a year and a half. It's actually relatively small in terms of the stimulus this year is driving GDP growth to kind of record levels, you know, 5 or 6% kind of GDP growth this year. But, you know, when we talk about the stimulus and then also we're going to pay for it with tax increases, the benefit to GDP growth, even going out to 22 and 23, is actually relatively minor. So I think whether it passes or doesn't pass, you know, the impact on GDP is going to be relatively minor from my perspective. It'll impact certain industries more than others, but from the overall macroeconomic environment, it won't be a massive change from my perspective.
Okay, thanks for answering that. Norman asks a question, would a change in political parties in power affect your idea about utility investments?
Actually, it's a good question, but the answer is no. Now, again, like I said, it's unlikely, I think, that if you had Republicans in control of the presidency and the Senate, you might not see a big subsidy coming for Exelon. That may not happen. But generally speaking, what's happening today in utilities, it has a little bit less to do with politics. It has more to do with just economics. Because what's happening today is it's actually cheaper to close down a coal plant, close down some old gas plants, and replace that with wind and solar, and maybe over time, storage and hydrogen. It's just very good economics. It's good for the environment. It's good for the rate payer. It's good for the utilities. That's a really powerful combination. And that combination is really independent of which party is in power.
Well, it's nice to know that politics doesn't influence everything. So two more questions we've got that I want to put to you. Wen asks, what do you think about closed-end funds for an income-producing portfolio?
Well, I think you have to be a little bit careful about closed-end funds. Some closed-end funds use a lot of leverage, and you got to make sure that you get a higher yield, but you're also taking a lot more risk. So you just got to make sure you're mindful of that additional risk that you're taking in a closed-end fund. Also, a lot of closed-end funds typically trade at big discounts to sort of their NAV. So again, what I would tell investors who are thinking about investing in closed-end funds, look at where the historical relationship between NAV and how big a discount they have. When that discount gets wide, they might be an attractive investment. When that discount gets narrow relative to history, I think you want to probably back away from a little bit from those closed-end funds. And just be mindful of the fees as well. Sometimes closed-end funds have very, very high fees. And so just be mindful that your returns don't get eaten up by high fees, if you will.
Understood. So I think you'll like the last question. William wants to know, can you tell us how we can be notified about the publication of your book?
Oh, how we can get it's actually available on public. It's available on Amazon pre-order. It comes out in October. So thank you for asking the question. And I've been wanting to write this book for a long period of time and just never had the time to do it. So I found the time over the last couple of years on the weekends to do this. And I hope it is it's an enjoyable read for people who are who are board members, you know, finance people, but also people who just like to hear stories about great companies and how they create a lot of value through really intelligent capital allocation and some companies destroyed a lot of value through unintelligent capital allocation. So I hope it's a book that a lot of the viewers will enjoy. I've enjoyed writing it, clearly.
So what's harder, writing a book or managing money in this market?
Oh, well, that's it. I think managing money in this environment is actually difficult. It's kind of funny to say that. From my perspective, it's actually a lot easier managing money when there's kind of blood in the streets, when there's a lot of negative sentiment, because I think over time that will revert and we'll be able to make our clients a lot of money. So, you know, again, we put $9 billion of our shareholders' capital to work in kind of February, March, when the market was selling off. And it felt horrible, but it was the right thing to do. And today, a lot of the stocks we were buying back in March are three times what they were back in March, or twice as much as they were back in March. And now people love them, those stocks, those heavy cyclicals, if you will. So I actually enjoy investing more during that period of stress where you can kind of go against the market. When markets are expensive, you know, it's just it's less fun, right? There's less really great opportunity. You're really trying to do, like I said, keep up as best you can, but also protect your clients on the downside, which we know will inevitably come.
Good advice, David. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a lot of fun and very informative.
Good. I've enjoyed it. Thank you for the invitation.
A pleasure. I want to thank our listeners, too, for tuning in today to this conversation. Tomorrow, my colleague Beverly Goodman, Barron's Editorial Director of Investing and Asset Management, will be speaking with Reshma Kapadia, Associate Editor, for a conversation on why it's time to rethink index investing and how to choose a mutual fund. That is certainly a change of view given the past few years, and I suspect something you'd rather like, David.
Yes, that sounds interesting.
Okay, thank you again, and be well, everyone. Have a good day.